For the series A Book, A Thousand Stories, this is a review of John Suchet's The Last Waltz. Each episode is enriched by beautiful music selected by Gerald Fennec. The script is mine, Patricia Salomone. So, after 14 episodes, we are coming towards the end of John Suchet's fascinating book, The Last Waltz. The book now takes us to the early 20th century. The founders of the Strauss dynasty, Johann I, born in 1804, his sons Johann II, Joseph and Edward, are dead. The family saga gradually dwindles away, with some late heirs of the dynasty still performing. But the music of the founders lives on. It is now rooted in the DNA of the Viennese, of the Austrians. Page 248, we have a splendid photo of Johann Strauss III. And who is this? It is none other but Edward's son, the one who had shamed the family by being landed in prison for financial reasons. We are shown the picture of a proud, elegant man wearing a fashionable moustache, still bearing the family's curly dark hair, reminiscent of his father Eddie's famed good looks. He has put his prison episode behind him and picks up the family tradition of music. Suchet tells us that this young man, as Johann Strauss III, took full advantage of sharing the name of the great composer. He subtly renamed the orchestra, took it on tour, and performed at the Royal Albert Hall in London as Johann Strauss and his own Viennese orchestra. He was also a composer, but he never reached the heights that his predecessors had attained. Johann III died on the 9th of January 1939, aged 72. Suchet writes, "Perhaps he was fortunate to die just before the outbreak of the Second World War. For what would happen to the reputation of his family under the Nazis would surely have left him stunned and angry." This was indeed a nasty story, but I will ask my listeners to put this matter on the back burner for the time being and allow me to follow the destiny of Der Alte Herr, who survived both the men who would have been called to be his eventual heirs, his own son Rudolf, and his nephew, Franz Ferdinand. By the start of the First World War, Franz Josef was a very frail old man, worn out by his imperial duties and the pain of a series of family tragedies. His death, in 1916, is announced in the book in a rather unorthodox manner. Katharina Schrocht's world ended on the 21st of November, 1916, when the Lord High Chamberlain telephoned her from Schönbrunn Palace to say that the Emperor was dead. Much though this is the story of the Strauss family, it is also, as we have seen, intermingled with the life of Emperor Franz Joseph. And much though His Imperial Majesty appears frequently on the pages of our book, in my opinion, the circumstances of his death are not given sufficient coverage. We are, however, shown on page 254 a photo of the crypt in the Kapuzinerkirche, where the imperial family lies buried. Franz Joseph, with Empress Elizabeth on the left and Crown Prince Rudolf on the right, closer in death than ever they were in life. These few words tell a long and tragic story. Briefly, Suscha states that Franz Joseph was buried with all the pomp of a great state funeral, sovereigns and princes of the empire converging to Vienna. Kati Schracht stayed away from the official ceremony, but in acknowledgement of her importance in the emperor's life, she had been admitted to his private apartments while he still lay on his plain iron bed. Suscha writes, Kathy walked to the bed, placed two white roses on the emperor's hands, and bent over him, her eyes closed in prayer. It was just as well that the old emperor, who had reigned for nearly 70 years and strived so hard to keep his empire together, did not live to see its disintegration and the defeat of Austria and Germany.
Early in December 1916, Franz Josef was the last monarch to be interred in the Kapuziner Gruft while the monarchy still existed. His great nephew and successor, the blessed Karl I, died in exile in 1922 in the Portuguese island of Madeira. He is still buried there in the church of Nossa Senhora do Monte in Funchal, the island's chief town. However, his heart was interred in the Swiss monastery church of Muri together with that of his widow Zita, the last empress, who died aged 97 in 1989, but buried in the Kapuziner Gruft in Vienna. The 99-year-old eldest son Otto, the last crown prince of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, joined his mother in July 2011, just 7 years ago. This was the procedure which was always followed upon the burial of a member of the dynasty. Using a silver cane, the Grand Chamberlain of the Imperial and Royal Court knocks on the door of the Capuchin convent. The Capuchin porter asks who is there, and the Chamberlain replies with the name of the deceased emperor. In this case, it would be I, Franz Josef, Emperor of Austria, Apostolic King of Hungary, King of Bohemia, Croatia, Dalmatia, Slavonia, and so many other titles like Archduke of Austria, King of Jerusalem, Duke of Upper Silesia, Lord of Trent, of Sonnenberg, Trieste, of Modena, Parma, and so on. A long list of titles. After which, Upon hearing this, the porter refuses to open the door and says, "I do not know you." The Grand Chamberlain then knocks on the door again, and when the porter asks who is there, the Chamberlain says, "I am His Majesty, the Emperor and King." Yet again, permission is denied, and the same reply comes back, "I do not know you." Knocking for the third and last time, the Chamberlain is asked who wants to enter, and he replies, "I am Franz Josef, a poor mortal and a sinner." To this, the Capuchin porter replies, "Come in." The convent door is then opened wide, and the casket is brought in between a double row of Capuchin monks. A salvo of 21 cannon shots will announce to the city of Vienna that the coffin has entered forever the sacred crypt.
Kurtis Racht was to outlive the Emperor by many, many years. In the aftermath of her imperial lover's death and of the dramatic defeat, she struggled to make both ends meet and sold many of the precious gifts which she had been the recipient of. But once her usefulness at court had come to an end, she did not give up on life and reacquainted herself with her former theater world. It seems that she was the center of a busy social life at her small house in Heitzing, where she entertained friends well into her old age. Very much to her honor, acknowledging her role as the emperor's mistress, she, however, always refused compensation for telling her story to the press, stating, "I was never a pompadour, still less a maintenon." It is said that she angrily denied a press announcement wherein she was said to have accepted a pension from Herr Hitler. In fact, when in the spring of 1938 Hitler drove into Vienna after the Anschluss, she proudly pulled down the blinds of her windows. It is to Kurtis Racht's credit that she never revealed the secrets of her imperial companion, taking them with her to the grave. Kurtis Racht passed away in April 1940. She was 86 years old and died in the middle of the Second World War. She was spared the misery of witnessing a second defeat for Austria. Allow me now to return to the subject mentioned at the opening of this episode, the Nazi ill-treatment of the Strauss musical tradition. This sprung from the Nazis' obsession with giving prominence to all that was Aryan, which of course also included the arts and music very prominently among them. To the Hitler administration, Richard Wagner was indeed to epitomize the greatness of the Teutonic race. But the lighter, happy music of Johann Strauss was universally popular. This could not be ignored, and it had to be proven purely Germanic. Joseph Goebbels, propaganda minister of the Third Reich, took it on himself to prove this, notwithstanding that there were some obstacles. The first obstacle was the fact that Strauss was not German, but was, in fact, Austrian. This was quickly solved when in 1938 Anschluss took place and Austria became one with the Third Reich. The other seemingly unsurmountable problem was that Strauss' family had Jewish roots. This was anathema to a propaganda minister who published the 10 Principles of German Music Creativity, which stated, amongst other rules, that any infiltration of Jewish music in German culture had to be quelled. Strauss family was very much a Viennese family. Marriage records in St. Stephen's Cathedral, a Catholic cathedral, showed that Johann Strauss's great-grandfather Michael was a baptized Jew, whose parents Wolf and Theresia were both Jews. This meant that Johann Sr. was classified as half-caste, and his offspring were second-class half-caste. Goebbels set himself the task of erasing any possible proof of this fact and proceeded to the forgery of the precious documents. Thus began the saga of the St. Stephen Cathedral Register, which was removed and taken to the Department of Nationality and Race in Berlin. Here the entry showing the Strauss marriage was removed. The following entry moved up, and then the original register was meticulously microfilmed, page by page. The Nazis, being perfectionists, both the original and the forged copy, stamped with the official stamp of the Department of Nationality and Race and the Svastika of the Third Reich, dated 20th February 1941, were returned to Vienna. The copy was placed in St. Stephen's Cathedral, while the original was buried in some dark corner of the state archive. Here the story becomes more fantastical, almost surreal. Suchet recounts that legend has it that as the Nazis retreated from Vienna, destroying all that came in their path, a man ran through the streets of the city clutching the original register. He secreted it in the deep vault beneath St. Stephen's Cathedral. How he obtained it, or who he was, is unknown. Eventually, after the war, it was found intact. The story was made public on the 8th of June 1951 by the Arbeiter Zeitung. So, the register proving the Strauss family origins was saved. But as for other memorabilia pertaining to Johann Strauss, very little still remains, lost as it was in the destruction of the center of Vienna during the Battle of Vienna, including the house in the Eagelgasse, which Johann loved, and where he so often sought sanctuary from the pressures on him. After the Nazis, the destruction was completed by the Soviet Red Army. All Johann Strauss's personal belongings disappeared from archives and museums. Strauss's violin is nowhere to be found. Thus, the Nazi had managed to bury Strauss's Jewishness, which had come from the past. But they could do little to hide the fact that Adele, Strauss's wife, was Jewish, although she had converted to Catholicism to marry Johann. This meant that her daughter Alice, too, was Jewish. Adele died in 1930, but her daughter Alice was in her 60s, when World War II broke out. Alice had been much loved by the famous musician, whose widow had inherited much of his estate. When this lady died, it was natural that her daughter would inherit what was left of Johann's possessions. But the Nazis would have none of this, of course. So the Nazi propaganda went on to tarnish Adele's name. Not only was she a Jew, but she had taken advantage of Strauss when he had been old and weak. In reality, Johann II was in his mid-50s and fully in possession of all his faculties when he married Adele. Her daughter Alice, therefore, had no right to inherit anything that had belonged to her stepfather. Der Strummer, the Nazi propaganda sheet, accused her of holding on to precious material that should have been donated to Vienna. Alice was worn down by the attacks on her dignity. She was eventually deprived of all the keepsakes that her loving stepfather had given her. After the war, she went to live in Switzerland and was never compensated for what had been unlawfully taken from her. This sad story became known as late as the 1990s. I have now to bring my story to an end for today. I thank my kind collaborators and look forward to the next episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories, The Last Waltz.